to shout her name, to take her arm, to feel her warmth, and does nothing. At the building on Duane Street, he uses the elevator key that will let him out on the top floor. He passes the first two floors occupied by his most recent tenants. He passes the first of his own two floors and steps out into what he calls the studio. He doesn't switch on the lights. The long dark loft shimmers with the illumination of the city. This is where he always comes to sit on the leather couch and listen to music in the dark or to drowse into skittering images of the past. Even when he's alone, the room is crowded with the faces and names of the past. He sits down at the end of the couch, leans back, and looks up. The rain-streaked skylight is made of 126 panes. The skylight faces south, and he can see the green shimmering lights of the Woolworth Building to the left and the icy towers of the World Trade Center to the right.
"What about you?"
said Delfina Cintron. He wishes he could tell her the whole long tale. Once he understood that he would live for many years, Cormac had worked hard at placing his nostalgias in a mental jail. You lived in the present, but that present always contained a past, some image of a ruined paradise. Cormac noticed as the years passed that New Yorkers shared a sense that whatever had changed, they could do nothing about it. A kind of optimistic fatalism. Reformers arrived with golden promises and left office in disgrace and impotence. He had seen reputations blaze and then end up as burnt offerings. Even language had term limits. In separate long eras, Cormac heard people use words like fiddlesticks or groovy, and then one morning, as if a secret referendum had been passed, the words vanished. He watches a flock of tiny birds emerge from between the twin towers to fly past the upper stories of the Woolworth Building heading east. They know where they're going. He envies them for their freedom and their certainty. The next day, he spreads the clippings on the dining table on the lower floor. Cindy Adams, Liz Smith, Mitchell Fink. There's a spread in Town and Country and a talk with William Hancock Warren across three pages in Editor and Publisher. He is not the last of the Warren line, perhaps, but he's the most recent Warren to come to New York. Willie Warren, newspaper publisher supreme. A fresh young prince of New York. Cormac smiles and thinks, how can I think of killing a man called Willie? In many of the pictures, and most of the texts, there is also Elizabeth, the standard British trophy wife. A model for a few years, adored by French and Italian photographers for her high cheekbones, long neck, elegant shoulders, and sleek black hair. She has not modeled for anyone since meeting Willie Warren. The stories imply that she has one responsibility now, to be lean and perfect, to be perfect at dinner and, Cormac supposes, perfect in bed. He slides the clips around one final time, then assembles them like cards and gets up, thinking, they have no children. Why? Are they merely waiting, like yuppies, until all is secure in life and business? Cormac walks to the spiral staircase and winds around the steps to the upper studio. He flicks on lights, opens the door to the small office he calls the archive, and goes in. The wall to the right is completely covered with corkboard, most of it occupied by the Warren family tree. He drops the fresh clips into a wire basket to be filed later. For more than a century, he has been gathering the documents in the archive, the whole long saga of the Warrens who were the descendants and other relatives of the Earl of Warren. Here on the wall is the American branch, budding and tentative in Philadelphia after the Revolution, flowering in the coal mines of Pennsylvania, where years later they employed Pinkertons against Molly Maguires. Not all of them were parasites or predators. Two died at Gettysburg and one at Antietam, fighting for the Union, helping free the ancestors of men and women brought to America by the Earl and his friends. One of the remaining British Warrens, Richard Benoit Warren, died trying to save an Irish enlisted man in the Second Battle of the Somme. One Warren was killed at Anzio. One died on Iwo Jima. Some simply vanished, of course, to die in failure or brawls or forgotten wars. There is very little about the Earl and nothing about the son, Tony Warren, who died during the American Revolution. None of the narratives mention Cormac Samuel O'Connor. Cormac couldn't kill them all, of course, and didn't want to. Even if he'd had the desire, he couldn't leave Manhattan to track them down. Very early, he decided that the Warrens would only matter to him if they invaded this place, this Granite Island, this Manhattan. But after Cormac killed the Earl's son, the Warrens did not try to establish themselves in New York until the arrival of William Hancock Warren, who is here now, defying family superstition and ancient history. The first Warren in more than two centuries to take up residence in Manhattan. There are seven photographs of the man here, including one as a boy and one taken at his wedding. The man smiles. The man's eyes twinkle. In one, dressed in a tuxedo, he is juggling three balls. Cormac dials Delphina's number, but there is no answer. He leaves his name and number on her answering machine. Now he goes downstairs to the living area, to the book-lined walls, the dark bedroom. He is bound for his daily nap. Since the 1890s, this has been his indulgence, his pleasure, his necessity, the siesta. The daily routine is almost always the same, lunch, then a siesta, and then down to the streets for his walk, which he calls his Wordsworth. He traces this ambulatory habit to reading the great poet when he was young. One variation on the Wordsworth were the years in the 1890s that he spent trying to photograph every building on the island. The years he spent trying to freeze a city that could not be frozen. On weekends, when trucks are gone from the streets, along with thousands of suburban cars, he takes his bicycle to the streets and pedals for miles. He never walks fewer than 20 blocks and never pedals less than 60. In the 1970s, he began riding the bicycle late on summer nights when the asphalt had cooled, and there he would see mysterious black riders. One night, pedaling into Central Park after midnight, he saw one of those riders and was certain it was Kwako. Cormac said hello in Yoruba, hello and nice night, and the man said yes in Ashanti, yes, a nice night. They pedaled away and he never saw the man again. Now he removes his clothes and takes an old cotton nightshirt from a wall peg. He lies on the bed, but sleep does not come easily on this afternoon. The quarry rises in his mind. Years earlier, nobody in New York knew the name of William Hancock Warren. Now Cormac is thinking about him each day and seeing him in dreams. Only 9 years ago, he emerged as a public figure, as if visiting from the planet Krypton. That was when Cormac first saw his photograph. William Hancock Warren did what so many other rich men do when they want more than money. He bought a newspaper. The New York Light was not, to be sure, a thriving enterprise. For 18 years, the Light had been owned by a foundation whose members stated that they felt a civic obligation to subsidize the second oldest newspaper in the United States. One June morning in 1991, the board announced that if a new buyer was not found within 2 weeks, they would fold the paper. In stepped William Hancock Warren. On the 4th of July that year, Warren handed the foundation a check for $1 million and uttered only one sentence to the assembled television cameras, and as Cormac watched that evening on Channel 4, the words jolted his heart. "I'm a descendant of people who lived in New York before the Light was born. I hope to see it flourish and live to an even riper old age." Cormac thought that night, "This cannot be." But then he saw Warren's eyes and the familiar features and read everything he could find about the man who, in print, was now being called Willie Warren. If this was the last of one branch of the Warren line, the old vows required him to act. He wished he had the sword, his father's sword. He wished the sword were there to connect him to the younger man he once was, full of certainties. And there was something else pressing upon him now. He wanted more than ever to find the dark lady marked by spirals. She had nothing to do with the Warrens and the curse of Ireland. She was part of a separate story. And yet her story and the story of the Warrens were coming together. He had found a dark lady, Delphina Sintron. But he did not yet know if she bore the markings, if she was the Dark Lady. She calls after he returns from his walk. She is cool but not distant. They make a date for the theater. Next week, under the marquee. Then she says goodbye, and he stands there holding the cordless phone. I must move more quickly, he thinks. I must move closer to her, and soon, to find out if I can love her. I, who have loved no woman for so many years. The telephone keeps her present in his life as he waits for their night at the theater. Sometimes they speak twice in a day, at noon and at night. She talks about how she hates working at the drugstore, and he says she must find another job where she can use her brains. Then one day she tells him she is taking a day off from Rite Aid to apply for three jobs, one in a bank on 48th Street, another at a dot-com outfit on Green Street, another in a law firm in the World Trade Center. He wishes her luck, but says she should be careful about the dot-commers. There is a collapse underway. On Saturday morning, she calls.
I got it, she says. I got the job. The one at the World Trade Center. They hired me. Can you flicking believe it?
She comes downtown and they celebrate in Chinatown at a place called Oriental Gardens on Elizabeth Street.
Thank you, Cormac,
she says and reaches across the table and squeezes his right hand.
If it wasn't for you...
Stop, he says. This is all you. You did it. I didn't. He pays the bill with cash. They go out together into bright sunshine. They walk together toward Canal Street, passing the old police station marked 1881, the year of the gunfight at the OK Corral, and the year that Henry James published Portrait of a Lady. He thinks, what a marvelous country. I'll see you at the theater, she says, getting into a taxi.
And Cormac, thanks again.
Cormac waits for Delphina under the marquee of the Royal Theater on West 45th Street, searching the crowds for her face. The wind off the river is raw for May, and there are gusts of rain driving most people into the shallow lobby or directly to their seats. Delphina Cintron, raincoat collar high, cheeks rouged by the wind, sees him, whispers a hello, takes his arm, and they go in to see Copenhagen.
I'm so excited, she says. A play, a Broadway play.
As they watch the first act, he hears her making several gasping sounds. At the end, he and Delphina join in the standing ovation and then move slowly back up the aisle toward the street.
Thank you so much, Cormac, she says. It meant a lot to me. I could feel things popping in my brain, you know? Like tiny little dead things suddenly coming to life. It was like, if you didn't use certain muscles for a long time, then you do, and pop, pop, pop.
She steps into the bright darkness of his studio on Duane Street and gazes at the skylight. She makes the same small gasping sound he heard in the theater. She moves forward and stands very still, looking through the panes of the skylight.
Up there, she says, way up there, the 84th floor, that's my office.
She looks amazed.
I can see you from there. Anyway, I can see your roof.
She looks up at him, and he puts a hand on her waist, and she eases into him like a partner in a slow dance. In the dark bedroom a floor below the studio, they lie together for a long while, her body pressed against his, her head on his chest. Her breathing slows into comfort, and his follows. Away off, the city murmurs through the thick drapes. Finally, she rises on one elbow and gazes at him.
Who are you, anyway? She says.
I was thinking the same thing about you. She giggles, then stands up. She demands the tour, and he gives it to her. The two of them barefoot in terry cloth bathrobes. She examines the first floor as if it were a museum, her eyes moving over the long rows of tall bookshelves, the paintings, the African masks. They can both hear rain now spattering on the four windows on the Duane Street end. She stops to examine herself in a large white and gold mirror, a hand going to her rain-exploded hair, which now looks like a black wiry halo. He wraps his arms around her and then fumbles with the knot of the robe until it opens. He sees his own pale hand gently holding a dark-skinned breast, and her head leaning back into him, lips parted, and his hand moving down her belly. To the twin spirals. They are there, traced lightly, delicately on her skin, facing each other like enraptured sea serpents. She is the dark lady with the spirals. His fingertips trace their outlines, their wide bottoms vanishing into the thick black V of her pubic hair. She pushes back into him and must feel his hardening.
Are they disgusting to you? She says.
They're beautiful, he says.
Hold me tight, she says.
Later, rising from the floor, she tightens the robe and walks to the kitchen. She opens the refrigerator, picks a crisp green grape, munches it, grabs a handful, then takes a bottle of water and closes the door. Then she moves slightly to her left, peering down the corridor.
This is beautiful, she says.
It's comfortable, Cormac says, sounding to himself like a real estate salesman. I like being here. She looks directly at him, her eyes liquid.
Me too. I never met anyone rich before, she says and giggles.
I'm not rich.
Come on. A place like this costs a mint.
Not when I got it, he says. It was just a dump then. Hoping she doesn't ask what year. That night he dreams of swimming in a vast sea, his body making wide spirals in the water. They glow against the dark waters. Something comes from beneath him, bumping, pushing him. He awakes in sweat and tears. The clock tells him that it's 8:48. She's gone into the gray morning. He is not surprised. He is, in fact, relieved. There is nothing more clumsy than the talk on the morning after the first night before. He walks south on Broadway in the Sunday morning quiet. At the Battery, he goes to the final iron railing where he can hear the languid slapping of the sea. Images of Delphina move through him. They are there, Cormac thinks. The spirals are there. I've traced them with my tongue. She calls him about 6. She is shy at first, then more direct.
My tattoos didn't disgust you, she says.
Not at all. They're like sea serpents, or snakes in a Hindu temple.
I've never seen a sea serpent, or a Hindu temple.
She pauses and her voice flattens.
I got them to make myself disgusting. I wanted to scare men away. I thought, if I can scare them with something, their cocks will die.
Cormac wants to laugh, but doesn't. In her way, she's letting him know that she will take sex when she chooses to have it, but she will not be hurt. He listens to the words beyond the hardness. Who did them for you? He asks.
Some guy uptown, she says. Way uptown, like on the top of the island. I can't even remember his name. Black dude. Blacker than any black man I ever saw. Talks in some African accent, maybe 60 years old, maybe older. To get the bottoms where I wanted them, I had to shave. In a way that turned me on, but it didn't do anything for the old man. Between the tattoo and the shave, I itched for a month.
She laughs.
They sure didn't work with you, she says. I mean, didn't scare you off. I'm glad. Until last night, I hadn't fucked anyone in almost 2 years.
The telephone rings around midnight. Cormac picks it up, drops his voice, thinking it's Delphina, whispers,
Hello?
How seductive. Are you awake? It is Healy, his friend, his last friend. The rule behind most New York friendships is, don't ask, don't tell. If Healy doesn't ask, Cormac will not tell. Healy never asks. He's the last of the old-style bohemians, the author of 3 good plays that had long runs off-Broadway in the early 1960s, which meant he was shaped by the 1950s, when the worst sin of all was to name names. I just opened the mail 10 days late, and there's an invite to the Metropolitan Museum tomorrow night, some kind of a New York art show. Go with me, it should be a million laughs.
What time?
7:30. I'll see you on the steps. There's a milling crowd on the steps of the Metropolitan, made of tourists and visitors from New Jersey, and a slew of photographers dressed in formal wear. A huge banner proclaims the name of the show, Art in the Empire City, New York, 1825 to 1861, and Cormac smiles, thinking, I am the only person here who actually lived in that lost city. Healy is standing with some tourists just short of the top step. He hands Cormac a ticket. Photographers are inside the main hall, and a few reporters scribbling notes, and several hundred people in what used to be called evening wear. A young woman photographer confronts Healy with a notebook in hand.
"Excuse me, sir," she says. "Can you tell me your name?"
"I don't have a name. I'm a nobody." Then more white lights explode, walking in the door of the people Cormac has come to see, William Hancock Warren and his wife, Elizabeth. "This is hard to believe," Healy says. "I mean, this isn't Vladimir Putin. This is a real estate guy that owns a paper." Healy moves into the crowd while Cormac watches Elizabeth Warren, who is chatting with an elderly woman. Cormac moves around casually, drawing Elizabeth Warren in his mind. She's indeed a beauty of a classic English type. Smooth, cream-colored skin. Lean, athletic body sheathed in a black Valentino frock. The Warrens merge with the crowd of several hundred people and vanish into the blur of black tuxedos. The older guests know this event is just another New York ritual. The celebrities are there to draw the media. Cormac can't see Warren, or the mayor, or the governor. They must be chatting in a private room. He separates himself from the crowd and drifts into the galleries to look at the remnants of the world where he once lived. A picture catches his eye. He crosses the gallery to look at a carefully painted view of dark buildings and a sky lit up by furious orange flames. Engulfed by the flames are chimneys, useless ladders, roofless walls. The caption explains that this is the Great Fire of 1835 and the painter is anonymous. Cormac knows better. The painter was Cormac Samuel O'Connor. Then he senses an odor of perfume. A woman leans in beside him to read the caption. Elizabeth Warren.
"I didn't know that New York had a great fire too," she says in a cool way. "London did, of course."
"This was an amazing fire too," Cormac says. "It destroyed more than 700 buildings, a third of the city." She straightens up, her head rising on her long neck, and she looks at Cormac with her wide-spaced hazel eyes.
"Are you a historian?"
"Well, I've read a lot of the city's history." He can't tell her that he is in the painting too, there in the distance, tiny and furtive in the purple shadows under the orange flames.
"New York does have a history, doesn't it?" she says. "So many American cities have a past but no history."
Cormac looks at her and smiles. "That's true," he says, and feels that a last act is beginning. In the morning, Cormac calls Delfina and gets her machine. He leaves a message. In the shower, he feels a jittery nervousness, as if various unseen filaments are trying to form a web. After the shower, dressed, he sees the message light blinking. He plays it.
"Hello, this is Elizabeth Warren. We met last night at the museum. My husband and I are having a dinner party on Friday night, and I'd love it if you could come. We could talk more about great fires and such."
He calls back and gets a social secretary with a French accent and writes down the details, thinking, "The rivers are converging." In the foreground is Delfina, but now back near the tree line, in an imagined landscape, Elizabeth Warren makes her appearance too. In small ways, Delfina is revealing herself, and so is Cormac. They speak by telephone. They send emails. Delfina begins to relax with him, to make bad jokes, to be at once younger and older. She avoids asking about his past, and she never mentions the future. She has a new job and wants to do well, but the job, like Cormac, is part of the present tense, along with food, drink, and bed. When he's alone, he realizes that she is living one narrative and he is living another. He doesn't mention Elizabeth Warren, and he is not certain what Delfina's hidden narrative contains. His own contains too many secrets. The butler is tall, dark-haired, about 40. He nods at Cormac's name, takes a drink order, and says, "They're all out on the terrace, Mr. O'Connor." Elizabeth Warren is coming to greet him.
"Oh, Cormac, welcome, welcome."
Dressed in a black Armani frock, a sudden glitter of diamonds from her earrings. She grasps each of his hands in greeting, her own hands cool, then leads him toward the balcony. They're on the top floor of a triplex, high above Fifth Avenue, a few blocks north of the Frick. Willie Warren himself comes forward, and Elizabeth introduces them. He smiles in a tentative way, lifts a tumbler of scotch in salute. He has a pleasant smile. "Ah, yes, Mr. O'Connor." You're a kind of historian, I take it. I've heard so much about you from Elizabeth. Welcome. And then it's like an anthology of 1,000 other New York dinner parties. Drinks, remarks, and rehearsed wit mixed with testing, auditioning, seducing. All remain true to certain New York traditions, which Cormack first saw in the Brownstone Republic in the 1840s. It's bad form at social gatherings to ask a stranger what he or she does for a living. As he's introduced, Cormack is not asked what he does. The Metropolitan is still brightly lit, its roof washed coppery green, and lights mark the paths cut into the blackness of the park. Then Warren is beside him. Every time I see this view, Warren says, at this time of the evening, I feel like I've died and gone to heaven. So what kind of history are you writing? It'll be about New York. I guess I'll write it to find out what it is. Hey, what about you taking a crack at doing, I don't know, a history column for us? You know, giving us some of that goddamn context. If the mayor and his wife have a battle over Gracie Mansion, tell us who Gracie was. Good idea, Cormack hears himself saying. But I'd better finish what I'm doing first. God damn it, Warren says with enthusiasm. We could have a weekly feature just on the names of streets. The butler arrives on the terrace.
Ladies and gentlemen, dinner is served.
They go down a flight of carpeted stairs to the next level and pass into another large living room, designed as a refuge from winter, then into the wood-paneled dining room. A single, perfectly lit drawing by Rubens. Warren is at one end of the long polished table, Elizabeth at the other. Cormack is to her left. At tables like these, generation after generation, Cormack has heard variations on the same question. What did the Africans want? What did the South want? What did the Irish want, and the Italians, and the Jews? And of course, what did women want? He glances back toward the living room and is startled by a gigantic Lucian Freud painting of an immobilized man and a fat, naked woman, raw and brutal. What does Lucian Freud want? And as the courses arrive, he remembers those great groaning boards of the 19th century and the men and women whose motto was, "We eat, therefore we are." The era of the 25,000-calorie meal. Tonight, Cormack thinks, the guests of the Warrens are unwittingly doing what their obscene social ancestors did, behaving like the people who provoked the French Revolution. The talk goes back and forth, sometimes joined by all the guests, sometimes breaking down to knots of two or three. Globalization and the Middle East, and Alaskan oil drilling and stem cell research. Elizabeth is cool and distracted, ushering in each new course with the tinkle of a golden bell. She says little. She does not flirt. Not with Cormack, not with anyone. They all rise and begin to drift and scatter. A few slip away home, their minds already on breakfast meetings. Cormack pauses to look more carefully at the Rubens. Then he strolls down one of the corridors. Elizabeth is behind him.
It's the fourth door on the right, she says, if you need the little boy's room, Cormack.
He bows and thanks her. Into the men's room. Outside again, another door is open. Elizabeth waves him in.
Each room has a kind of theme, she says, tracing the history of the United States through furniture, art, interior decoration. My husband's idea, she says. The Warrens have been here a long time.
In the next room, through a connecting door, World War I and a doughboy helmet and photographs from the AEF. They pass from Gold Rush to the Mauve Decade.
Or the Gilded Age, Elizabeth says, or the gay '90s.
To Prohibition, a room for each. San Francisco newspaper headlines. Photos of costume parties. Cormack and Elizabeth entered another room. Photographs of Elizabeth at girls' boarding school in Switzerland, with parents, slightly dowdy, in Folkestone, standing beside Warren on the worn steps of an Anglican church.
This is my study, she says. It has no decor at all.
Then, to the side of the bookcase, Cormack sees a Georgia O'Keeffe painting of a lily, and to the side of it a graphite drawing he made many years ago. It shows the secret place of the Countess de Chardon. Where did you get this? He says. She smiles, gently tips the door closed.
That? You like that, I suppose. I'm almost sure it's from Christie's. They told me it was probably done around 1861 or 62, in there somewhere.
Wrong by almost 30 years.
I already had the Georgia O'Keeffe, she says. And when I saw this, I thought she might have made the drawing too. She was certainly the greatest 20th century painter of cunts.
She likes saying the word, although when she says cunt, it sounds shaved. She turns, eases her buttocks onto the corner of her desk, pressing against wood, staring at Cormac. I see what you mean, Cormac says, particularly if you turn the O'Keeffe upside down. She smiles in a neutral way. In the hall, she opens another door and flicks a switch. One more thing, she says. Inside, in indirect light, he sees frayed medieval battle flags behind glass, lithographed views of Jerusalem, dead crusaders, men holding crosses.
My husband's other museum, she says. All pretty ghastly and very interesting.
Cormac's heart stops. On the wall to the right, hanging from hooks by leather thongs, some jammed into cracked leather scabbards, are five weapons. In the center, longer than the others, its corroded face marked by spirals, is his father's sword. He leaves the party in a state of fevered blur and icy clarity. At the door, Warren tells Cormac they must lunch once he returns from a 10-day trip to Europe and Israel. Elizabeth gazes at Cormac in a cool way and shakes his hand at the elevator door. He starts down Fifth Avenue. His heart is beating hard. His father's sword, hanging like a trophy on a rich man's wall. And not any rich man, this rich man, descendant of his father's murderer. He thinks, I must have it. Must devise a plan to go back and once more hold my father's sword. And then, for the final time, I must wield it. As he walks downtown on Fifth Avenue, he knows this will not be easy. The rich live well-defended lives. And then he stops. What about Delfina? And answers himself. Timing is all. Elizabeth Warren calls and asks Cormac to breakfast on Sunday morning. A wash of betrayal passes through him, as if he were cheating on Delfina, but he agrees to meet Elizabeth in a hotel restaurant just north of Washington Square. The hotel dining room is cozy with dark wood and tinted steel engravings of little old New York. She's wearing one of those expensive pink jogging suits and dark violet sunglasses and a white cotton beret under which she has bundled her hair.
A ghastly morning, she says. It's like London out there.
The sun will burn it off in an hour.
One hopes.
She gazes around.
How cozy. And I'm famished. I want one of those gigantic American breakfasts.
Elizabeth finishes before Cormac, talking all the while about the president and missile defense.
I so wish I could belch, Elizabeth says, but the ghost of Mrs. Trollope is intimidating.
She talks then about Page Six and the gossip columns in the Daily News.
Let me ask you something, she says. Are you a free man? You're not married, I take it. But do you have a woman?
A moment of hesitation. I'm seeing a lot of a woman. She smiles in a rueful way.
God damn it. Before we moved here, one of my friends warned me. All the attractive men are married or drunks or gay.
She sips her coffee.
But I'd like to see more of you. You look like a man who can keep a secret, and there's something you can help me do.
She glances at her watch.
I have to see my husband, alas. I'd better go.
She leans close, kisses him on the mouth, then she turns and walks across the restaurant, hips ratcheting, and goes out into the city. Outside, the fog has lifted. There's something about Elizabeth Warren, he thinks. That is not Elizabeth Warren. The cool Elizabeth at breakfast revealed someone hotter and darker. Clearly she's pulling me, a total stranger, into something that she wants me to do. Something about her husband. As if her need has detected my need. As if she wants help in a killing. He reaches the Astor Place station and then sees a man coming up the stairs. His name is Bobby Simmons, and he has skin the color of tea with milk, hair almost white, a hunched stance. He's carrying a worn saxophone case covered with hotel decals.
God damn, Simmons says. It's you for sure, ain't it? Cormac O'Connor himself.
I didn't know you were back from Europe, Cormac says.
6 weeks now, and damn, the dirty old apple looks good. Hey, where you going?
Home?
No, you ain't. You coming with me. I got a gig down here on 11th Street, and I need a piano player.
The place is called the Riff Club, and fills an old dining room off the lobby of a small hotel. The operators of the club are experimenting with afternoon concerts on weekends. They go into a small room to the side of the bar. The bass player looks at his watch as they enter.
Cormac, this is Justin Gilbert, great bass player out of Juilliard, just like Miles. Cormac O'Connor, our piano player for today.
Where's Artie?
The young bass player says.
Called in wrecked, Simmons says.
Fuck,
Justin says, his annoyed face annoying Cormac. He's 22 years old, Cormac thinks, and he acts like he's Milt Hinton.
Cormac played with me before, Simmons says. Before you were born, Justin, so relax, man.
The bass player sighs. So what are we gonna play?
Duke,
says Simmons. That's the rehearsal. They walk out on stage. Cormac is nervous. He doesn't care about failing in front of the audience. He just doesn't want to fail Bobby Simmons. He flexes his fingers, then, very slowly, in a blues tempo, he plays an introduction to Take the A-Train, and then the release. Justin's bass is deep and powerful, as steady as a heartbeat, and here comes Bobby Simmons, attacking the old melody, driving it hard, the notes flying over the piano and the bass, playing the Ellington tune as if nobody had ever played it before, while honoring it as an old New York anthem. The crowd erupts. They yell and stomp feet on the old hotel floor and cheer through the final ride. Without a break, Cormac moves into Sophisticated Lady, slowing the mood into a smoky midnight sound. At the break between sets, Cormac hurries to the telephone and calls Delfina.
You might want to come down here, he says. I'm playing piano in a band.
He tells her about meeting Bobby Simmons, gives her the address of the Riff Club. They are in the second set with A Night in Tunisia when Delfina comes in. She's wearing a black sweater and black slacks, and her skin glows. There is one final tune, Flying Home, roaring and blazing, and then the set is over. The room roars for more. Even Justin Gilbert looks happy. Cormac hurries to Delfina. She rises from her chair and throws her arms around him. They go to Duane Street and make love at dusk, and then order Chinese food and eat and talk and make love again. She asks him to play for her. He presents her with a nocturne, as if it were a gift. She listens intently, curled like a cat in a chair. That night, he enters the Delfina summer. She is the essential element, humid and loamy, with her long thin legs in odd contrast to the thick pliancy of her flesh. They meet without plans, without agendas. They keep a cool, respectful distance from each other, too, which makes the moment of intimacy even more fevered. He has his friends, like Healy. She has hers, whose names and faces he does not know. What matters is what happens when they are together, the music of the present tense. After the first tentative weeks, they stop performing and shift into being. They dine together in restaurants, visit museums, go to see shows or movies, as he shows her in New York she has seldom seen. Eventually, on every day that they are together and without concern for clocks, they make love. Always in his place, never in hers. She makes clear without saying a word that she is entering his life, but that he is not yet entering hers. Do you believe in God? Cormac asks her at a show of religious tapestries at the Metropolitan.
I believe in gods, she answers, plural.
And that draws him closer to her, as a dozen gods move through him from the Irish mist, and he wonders if they could ever merge with the sun-soaked gods of the Caribbean. There could be a tapestry of gods as profuse as flowers. They talk about monotheism and how it has led to so many slaughters. He wonders out loud why that single God is always so cruel.
Because he wants love, man, she says, and he can't get it. Look at all the commandments. They all say, love me or die. What a weird message. God insists that you love him. He says, if you don't love me, I'll punish you with boils and plagues and locusts. His vanity is endless. Love me, he says, love me, love me, love me. He's supposed to be the most powerful being in the universe. El Señor, the father of us all, and he comes across as a huge pain in the ass.
She laughs when she says these things, which means she is serious.
I mean, the real gods are not so jealous, man. Not so vain. They have weaknesses like everybody else, and they have real jobs. They have to take care of water and fire and the sky and the stars. I mean, they're too busy, man, to demand love from each and every person on the planet. They got the whole damn universe to take care of.
And then she smiles in a secret way. She is sometimes baffled by him. One sweltering Saturday, she wants to show him Orchard Beach along the shores of the Bronx, where conga players drum into the night.
You gotta hear these guys, Cormac, she says. They'll shake up your gonads.
He can't go and can't explain why. She wants to see a show at the Brooklyn Museum. He's busy and she goes alone. She arrives one evening with CDs from J&R Music by Benny Moore and Tito Rodriguez. She plays them and begins to dance while he sits and watches.
Come on, man. You can't hear this music and sit.
And he gets up, clumpy, stiff, awkward, and she laughs and says,
Man, you are gonna be a project.
When he's alone, longing for her abundant presence, he speaks to her in the emptiness.
To tell the truth, Delphina, my life has no shape at all. There are no straight lines. I have this strange life, but it's not in the end strange at all. There is no plot. There is only luck and chance.
The Delphina summer was not a neat sequence of day following night following day. Her part of the summer was condensed, edited together in his mind by his need for a story. But he still took his naps and went for his walks. He felt a need to read again the books that had enriched his life, and so he took down Don Quixote and read it in 3 days, and was filled with sadness.
Don't listen to them, old knight, he said to the emptiness. They are not windmills. They are dragons.
And wondered what Quixote would make of the Woolworth Building and the Twin Towers. Cormac also saw Elizabeth Warren. They met twice for lunch, each time in a hotel. 3 weeks later, it's room service at the Millennium facing the World Trade Center across Church Street. He feels as if he's doing an audition. She needs him in some way that she has not spelled out. He needs her to get to his father's sword, and at the places the sword will take him. In a room on a high floor of the Millennium, they make love. She is awkward, in the way that some models are permanently awkward, as if thrown back to the gawky, breastless girls they once were, when no boys would see beyond the braces glittering in their mouths. She wears her passion as if it were rouge.
You're what I thought you'd be, she says when they are done. Just marvelous.
He thinks of Delphina, who never gives him a review. She is out there beyond the window of the hotel, across the plaza, on the 84th floor of the North Tower. He wishes he could enter the air, do some marvelous dance high above the city, as light and graceful as Fred Astaire. Dance for Delphina, dance to her, and let the harbor winds cleanse his shame. Delphina calls before daylight on a morning in the third week of August. Her voice is quick, almost abrupt, and thin with tension.
I'm on my way to the Dominican Republic, she says. My father is dying.
She has seldom mentioned him in their time together. He was, she said once, handsome, at least in her small girl's memory. He played piano in various bands around Santo Domingo.
I hope all goes well for you, Delphina. For him too. Vaya con Dios.
Then she's gone. Cormac feels time expanding, contracting, then expanding once again. Through the pages of the New York Light, he keeps track of the separate journeys of the Warrens. While Delphina is off on her own journey, Elizabeth is photographed in an African village and then meeting with a UN investigator. Willie Warren writes, or dictates, articles on peace in Northern Ireland and how it could be a model for peace in the Middle East, each article running with a photograph of Warren shaking hands with the leading politicians. Delphina calls collect late in the evening. The connection is bad.
My father's still alive. But, quién sabes, mi amor? Hey, I'll try to find a better phone and call you tomorrow.
She doesn't call. Elizabeth does. She's back in town. Can he come to dinner? The doorman looks at Cormac as if he's a jewel thief. He fixes his hooded eyes on Cormac while he calls the penthouse, then hangs up. Penthouse, he says. Take a ride to the elevator. Cormac is carrying a draftsman's case, purchased from Pearl's Paint on Lispinard Street. The elevator stops, the door opens, and Elizabeth Warren is smiling at him. The door clicks shut behind him, and he stands the draftsman's case against a small table.
Is there a rifle in that thing? She says, smiling.
Not even a round of ammunition. I promised a friend I'd loan it to him. He's an artist, lives over on 2nd Avenue. They walk down the hall, past the many cream-colored doors.
I've arranged some soup for us and sandwiches, she says. We almost never eat anything in the evenings, except when William is entertaining. He'll be gone a few more days in Israel, getting a tour of the terrorist outposts. And the maids are off tonight.
She talks about Israel and how Willie actually admires Ariel Sharon. Then she switches to national politics and the economy, speaking with intelligence and a certain journalistic precision. Cormac feels sludge seeping into his brain.
I told my husband you were coming here tonight, she says, just so you don't feel strange when you see him next.
She smiles, and they are into the dance. Later, in a small dim room behind her office, she falls limp and soft and silent for a while.
Were you thinking of someone else? She says.
Yes, he says, telling her the truth.
Poor woman, she says with a hint of bitterness. To have missed this.
Who are you thinking about?
My husband. I love him. I want to be with him the rest of my life.
I have a question, he says. What do you want from me?
Intimacy, I suppose.
The word breaks something in her. She starts to weep. He feels pity make its treacherous entrance. He holds her tight for a long time and she dozes. Intimacy. Another one of those big words that James Joyce said always get us in so much trouble. The nightman is on the door when Cormac comes down at 12:20. He strolls into the chilly blue air, the draftsman's case in his hand, heavier now than when he arrived. Now I have the sword, he thinks, and Delphina exists for me as vivid as dawn. If I can join these narratives, I'll be free. He goes to the curb, hails a taxi and gets in. He names his destination for the Pakistani driver, then sits back, the sword in its case on his lap. The window to his left is open to the night air. The taxi stops for a light at 59th Street. A figure draws up beside the taxi, a black bicycle rider, his head bare, gazing off to the left. The head turns, the black man smiles.
Hello, Cormac, he says. It's Congo. See you soon, he says in Yoruba.
And then turns the 10 speed against westbound traffic into a side street where the taxi cannot follow. Across the day, Cormac polishes the sword. He uses sandpaper and emery cloth and a burin to pry time's corrosion out of the etched spirals. He oils the steel. He sands again. On the day he took the sword, he saw Congo. All streams converge in one river. Now he traces the spirals, thinking of Delphina. With her spirals, she is never nude. She remains somewhere in the Dominican Republic.
Call me, mujer. Call tonight.
On his evening walk, he searches the blank streets for Congo but does not find him. Congo has arrived at last to be his Virgil, to lead him to the secret city of Emerald Light. The email is waiting when Cormac gets home, from Delphina, across the miles.
Cormac, querido. I'm writing this in a cyber cafe. My father is lying there in a hospital. This trip has reminded me that I do want to be with you, forever. With all my love, Delphina.
He speaks out loud in a voice full of amazement and sorrow.
I love her, he says. I love her.
On Sunday, the sky is gray and bleak. Cormac walks to the battery. White caps rise on the surly harbor. A freighter plods toward the Atlantic. Seagulls move in widening arcs. The sky is a smear, vacant of horsemen. He hears the voice of Mary Morrigan.
Something bad is coming.
He writes a will. He types a long, detailed note to Delphina explaining which books and paintings are valuable. He gives her the name of his lawyer. On Tuesday, he goes to the lawyer's office near Foley Square, signs the will. While copies are being made, Cormac gazes out the window of the lawyer's office. Down on the sidewalk, dressed in black, his arms folded across his chest, is Congo. Delphina calls from the airport around 8 o'clock on Wednesday night. She sounds drained.
I want to come to your house, she says, but it's been a long day. I'm tired and dirty and...
Tomorrow night is fine.
You sure? Then come to my house tomorrow night.
20 minutes later, there's another call. Elizabeth Warren. She's in Ottawa, cool but not cold, her voice rising into anger.
I called to tell you what you already know. You're a goddamn thief. My husband comes home this weekend, and I want that sword back on its hook.
Elizabeth, those spirals were cut into that blade by my own flesh and blood back in Ireland, more than 250 years ago.
Please, no fairy tales.
I've been cleaning it, polishing it. He hears a sob.
How could you have done that to me the other night? I wanted one simple thing from you, intimacy, and all you had in mind was theft.
Hunger eats at him now. He feels some remorse for what he has done to Elizabeth Warren, imagines her alone in a hotel room in Canada, imagines her own hunger. He decides to escape the house. Congo is across the street. They embrace and start walking together toward the river. Congo is wearing a zipper jacket and jeans, like a million other men in the autumn-like city. Silver is scratched into his hair, and there's a melancholy look in his eyes. He doesn't explain where he has been, nor does he ask Cormac about his own long life. Congo inhales the odor of the unseen river, and mentions a river in Gabon that has the same mixture of river and ocean salt.
If you are wounded on its banks, he says, the salt will heal you.
Cormac talks about how he has read his way into Africa through 100 books, absorbing the narrative of slavery and colonization and the bloody struggle of the 20th century to be free at last. Saw all of it merge into New York.
There's too many faces, too many people, Cormac says. Too many deaths and losses.
Congo looks at him.
I am an old man too, just like you. But one thing I have learned. After all the bloodshed and disease and horror, forgetting is more important than remembering.
They are at the river now. Lights twinkle on the distant Jersey shore.
Your frontier, Congo says and chuckles.